mystery, the summons of Eros, and the unknowable workings of the heart. I remember waiting for him to turn so I could see him, see his face. It was so odd. In a way, it was like an arranged match, where you wait with your heart fluttering to behold the face you will and must love. At last he turned. He was wrestling another boy. Even then, Zio, Dianeces was unhandsome. You could hardly believe he was his brother's brother. But to my eyes, he appeared euedestatos, the soul of beauty. The gods could not have crafted a face more open or touching to my heart. He was 13 then. I was 9. The lady paused for a moment, gazing solemnly down at the spot of which she spoke. The occasion did not present itself, she declared, throughout her whole girlhood when she could speak in private with Dianeces. She observed him often on the running courses and in the exercises with his Agoge platoon, but never did one share a moment with the other. She had no idea if he even knew who she was. She knew, however, that his brother had chosen her and had been speaking with the elders of her family. I wept when my father told me I had been given to Iatrocles. I cursed myself for the heartlessness of my ingratitude. What more could a girl ask than this noble, virtuous man? But I could not master my own heart. I loved the brother of this man, this fine, brave man I was to marry. When Iatrocles was killed, I grieved inconsolably. But the cause of my distress was not what people thought. I feared that the gods had answered by his death the self-interested prayer of my heart. I waited for Dianeces to choose a new husband for me, as was his obligation under the laws, and when he didn't, I went to him, shamelessly, in the dust of the palaestra, and compelled him to take me himself as his bride. My husband embraced this love, and returned it in kind, both of us over the still warm bones of his brother. The delight was so keen between us, our secret joy in the marriage bed, that this love itself became a curse to us. My own guilt I could requite. It is easy for a woman because she can feel the new life growing inside her that her husband has planted. But when each child was born, and each a female, 4 daughters, and then I lost the gift to conceive, I felt, and my husband did too, that this was a curse from the gods for our passion. The lady paused and glanced again down the slope. The boys, including my son and little Idaticides, had dashed out from the courtyard and now played their carefree sport directly below the site where we sat. Then came the summons of the 300 to Thermopylae. At last, I thought, I perceived the true perversity of the gods' plan. Without a son, my husband cannot be called. He will be denied this greatest of honors. But in my heart I didn't care. All that mattered was that he would live. Perhaps for only another week or month, until the next battle, but still he would live. I would still hold him. He would still be mine. Now Dianeces himself, his farm business completed within, emerged onto the flat below. There he joined playfully with the rough-housing boys, already obeying in their blood the instincts of battle and of war. "The gods make us love whom we will not," the lady declared, "and disrequite whom we will. They slay those who should live and spare those who deserve to die. They give with one hand and take with the other, answerable only to their own unknowable laws." Dianeces had now spotted Arete, watching him from above. He lifted the boy, Idaticides, playfully, and made the lad's little arm wave up the slope. Arete compelled her own to answer. "Now, inspired by blind impulse," she spoke toward me, "I have saved the life of this boy, my brother's bastard son, and lost my husband's in the process." She spoke these words so softly, and with such sorrow, that I felt my own throat catch and the burning begin in my eyes. "The wives of other cities marvel at the women of Lacedaemon," the lady said. "How," they ask, "can these Spartan wives stand erect and unblinking as their husbands' broken bodies are borne home to a grave, or, worse, interred beneath some foreign dirt with nothing save cold memory to clutch to their hearts? These women think we are made of stauncher stuff than they. I will tell you, Zio, we are not. Do they think we of Lacedaemon love our husbands less than they? Are our hearts made of stone and steel? Do they imagine that our grief is less because we choke it down in our guts?" She blinked once, dry-eyed, then turned her glance to mine. "The gods have played a game with you too, Zio. But it may not be too late to steal a roll of the dice. This is why I have given you this pouch of owls." Already I knew what her heart intended. "You are not Spartan. Why should you bind yourself by her cruel laws? Haven't the gods stolen enough from you already?" I begged her to speak of this no more. "This girl you love, I can have her brought here. Just ask it." "No, please." "Then run. Get out tonight. Go there." I replied at once that I could not. "My husband will find another to serve him. Let another die instead of you." "Please, lady, this would be dishonor." I felt my cheek sting, and realized the lady had struck me. "Dishonor?" She spat the word with revulsion and contempt. Down the slope the boys and Dianeces had been joined by the other lads of the farm. A game of ball had started. The boys' cries of agon, of contention and competition, pealed brightly up the slope to where the lady sat. One could feel only gratitude for that which had sprung so nobly from her heart, the wish to grant to me that clemency which she felt Moira, fate, had denied her. To grant to me and her whom I loved a chance to slip the bonds she felt herself and her husband imprisoned in. I could offer nothing save that which she already knew. I could not go. Besides, the gods would be there already, as ever, one jump ahead. I saw her shoulders straighten then, as her will brought to heel the gallant but impossible impulse of her heart. "Your cousin will learn where your body lies, and with what honor you perished. By Helen and the twins, I swear this." The lady rose from her bench of oak. The interview was over. She had become again a Spartan. Now, here on the morn of the march out, I beheld upon her face that same austere mask. The lady released her husband's embrace and gathered her children to her, resuming that posture, erect and solemn, replicated by the line of other Spartan wives extending fore and rear beneath the oaks. I saw Leonidas embrace his wife, Gorgo, bright eyes, their daughters, and his son, the boy Pleistarchus, who would one day take his place as king. My own wife, Theria, held me hard, grinding against me beneath her Messenian white robe while she held our infants crooked in one arm. She would not be husbandless for long. "Wait at least until I'm out of sight," I joked, and held my children whom I hardly knew. Their mother was a good woman. I wish I could have loved her as she deserved. The final sacrifices were over, omens taken and recorded. The 300 formed up, each peer with a single squire, in the long shadows cast by distant Parnon, with the entire army in witness upon the shield-side slope. Leonidas assumed his place before them, beside the stone altar, garlanded as they. The remainder of the whole city, old men and boys, wives and mothers, helots and craftsmen, stood drawn up upon the spear-side rise. It was not yet daybreak. The sun still had not peaked above Parnon's crest. "Death stands close upon us now," the king spoke. "Can you feel him, brothers?" "I do. I am human, and I fear him. My eyes cast about for a sight to fortify the heart for that moment when I come to look him in the face. Leonidas began softly, his voice carrying in the dawn stillness, heard with ease by all. Shall I tell you where I find this strength, friends? In the eyes of our sons in scarlet before us, yes, and in the countenances of their comrades who will follow in battles to come. But more than that, my heart finds courage from these, our women, who watch in tearless silence as we go. He gestured to the assembled dames and ladies, singling out two matriarchs, Pyrrho and Alcmene, and citing them by name. How many times have these twain stood here in the chill shade of Parnon and watched those they love march out to war? Pyrrho, you have seen grandfathers and father troop away down the Aphetaig, never to return. Alcmene, your eyes have held themselves unweeping as husband and brothers have departed to their deaths. Now here you stand again, with no few others who have borne as much and more, watching sons and grandsons march off to hell. This was true. The matriarch Pyrrho's son, Dorion, stood garlanded now among the knights. Alcmene's grandsons were the champions Alpheus and Merin. Men's pain is lightly borne and swiftly over. Our wounds are of the flesh, which is nothing. Women's is of the heart, sorrow unending, far more bitter to bear. Leonidas gestured to the wives and mothers assembled along the still-shadowed slopes. Learn from them, brothers, from their pain in childbirth which the gods have ordained immutable. Bear witness to that lesson they teach. Nothing good in life comes but at a price. Sweetest of all is liberty. This we have chosen, and this we pay for. We have embraced the laws of Lycurgus, and they are stern laws. They have schooled us to scorn the life of leisure which this rich land of ours would bestow upon us if we wished, and instead to enroll ourselves in the academy of discipline and sacrifice. Guided by these laws, our fathers for 20 generations have breathed the blessed air of freedom, and have paid the bill in full when it was presented. We, their sons, can do no less. Into each warrior's hand was placed by his squire a cup of wine, his own ritual chalice, presented to him on the day he became a peer, and brought forth only for ceremonies of the gravest solemnity. Leonidas held his own aloft, with a prayer to Zeus all-conquering, and Helen and the twins. He poured the libation. In years 600, so the poets say, no Spartan woman has beheld the smoke of the enemy's fires. Leonidas lifted both arms and straightened, garlanded, raising his countenance to the gods. By Zeus and Eros, by Athena protectress and Artemis upright, by the muses and all the gods and heroes who defend Lacedaemon, and by the blood of my own flesh, I swear that our wives and daughters, our sisters and mothers, will not behold those fires now. He drank, and the men followed him. Chapter 21. His Majesty is well familiar with the topography of the approaches, defiles, and the compressed battle plain wherein his armies engage the Spartans and their allies at the hot gates. I will pass over this, addressing instead the composition of the Greek forces and the state of discord and disorder which prevailed as these arrived and took station preparatory to defending the pass. When the 300, now reinforced by 500 heavy infantry from Tegea and a matching number from Mantinea, along with 2,000 combined from Orchomenus and the rest of Arcadia, Corinth, Phlius, and Mycenae, plus 700 from Thespiae and 400 from Thebes, arrived at Opuntian Locris, 10 miles from the hot gates, there to be joined by 1,000 heavy infantry from Phocis and Locris, they found instead the entire countryside deserted. Only a few boys and young men of the neighborhood remained, and these occupied themselves in looting the abandoned homes of their neighbors and appropriating whatever stores of wine they could disinter from their compatriots' caches. They took to their heels at the sight of the Spartans, but the rangers ran them down. The army and populace of Locris, the pimply pillagers reported, had taken to the hills, while the locals' chieftains were scurrying north toward the Persians as fast as their spindly shanks would bear them. In fact, the urchins claimed their headmen had already capitulated. Leonidas was furious. It was determined, however, in a hasty and decidedly ungentle interrogation of these farmyard freebooters, that the Locrians of Opus had gotten the day of assembly wrong. Apparently the month called Carneus in Sparta is named Lemendiaeon in Locris. Further, its start is counted backward from the full moon rather than forward from the new. The Locrians had expected the Spartans 2 days earlier, and, when these failed to appear, determined that they had been left in the lurch. They bolted amid bitter oaths and maledictions, which the gales of rumor scattered swiftly into neighboring Phocis, in which country the gates themselves are located, and whose inhabitants were already in terror of being overrun. The Phocians had hightailed it, too. All along the march north, the allied column had encountered country tribes and villagers fleeing, streaming south along the military road, or what had now become a military road. Tattered clan groups fled before the Persian advance, bearing their pitiful possessions in shoulder sacks contrived from bed covers or bundled cloaks, balancing their ragged parcels like water vessels atop their heads. Sunken-cheeked husbandmen wheeled hand barrows whose cargoes were more often flesh than furniture. Children whose legs had given out from the tramp, or bundled ancients, hobbled with age. A few had ox carts and pack asses. Pets and farm stock jostled underfoot, gaunt hounds cadging for a handout, doleful-looking swine being kicked along as if they knew they would be supper in a night or two. The main of the refugees were female. They trudged barefoot, shoes slung about their necks to save the leather. When the women descried the allied column approaching, they vacated the road in terror, scrambling up the hillsides, clutching their infants and spilling possessions as they fled. There came always that moment when it broke upon these dames that the advancing warriors were their own countrymen. Then the alteration which overtook their hearts bordered upon the ecstatic. The women skittered back down the hard scrabble slopes, pressing tight about the column, some numb with wonder, others with tears coursing down their road-begrimed faces. Grandmothers crowded forward to kiss the young men's hands. Farm matrons threw their arms about the necks of the warriors, embracing them in moments that were simultaneously poignant and preposterous. "Are you Spartans?" they inquired of the sun-blackened infantrymen, the Tegeates, and Mycenaeans, and Corinthians, Thebans, Phlians, and Arcadians, and many of these lied and said they were. When the women heard that Leonidas in person led the column, many refused to believe it, so accustomed had they become to betrayal and abandonment. When the Spartan king was pointed out to them and they saw the corps of knights about him and at last believed, many could not bear the relief. They buried their faces in their hands and sank upon the roadside, overcome. As the allies beheld this scene repeated 8, 10, a dozen times a day, a grim urgency took possession of their hearts. All haste must be made. The defenders must at all costs reach and fortify the pass before the arrival of the enemy. Unordered, each man lengthened stride. The pace of the column soon outstripped the capacity of the train to keep up. The wagons and pack asses were simply left behind to catch up as best they could, their necessaries transferred to the marching men's backs. For myself, I had stripped shoeless and rolled my cloak into a shoulder pad. My master's shield I bore in its hide case, along with his greaves and breastplate weighing something over 65 pounds. Plus both our bedding and field kit, my own weapons, 3 quivers of iron heads wrapped in oiled goatskin, and sundry other necessaries and indispensables, fish hooks and catgut, bags of medicinal herbs, hellebore and foxglove, euphorbia and sorrel and marjoram and pine resin, arterial straps, bindings for the hand, compresses of linen, the bronze dogs to heat and jam into puncture wounds to cauterize the flesh, irons to do the same for surface lacerations, soap, foot pads, moleskins, sewing kit. then the cooking gear, a spit, a pot, a handmill, flint and fire sticks, grit and oil for polishing bronze, oilcloth, fly for rain, the combination pick and shovel called from its shape a hissox, the soldier's crude term for the female orifice. This, in addition to rations, unmilled barley, onions and cheese, garlic, figs, smoked goat meat, plus money, charms, talismans. My master himself bore the spare shield chassis with double bronze facings, both our shoes and strapping, rivets and instrument kit, his leather corselet, two ash and two cornel wood spears with spare iron heads, helmet, and three xife, one on his hip and the other two lashed to the 40-pound rucksack stuffed with more rations and unmilled meal, two skins of wine and one of water, plus the goody bag of sweet cakes prepared by Ariti and his daughters, double wrapped in oiled linen to keep the onion stink of the rucksack from invading it. All up and down the column, squire and man humped loads of 200 or 220 pounds between them. The column had acquired a non-rostered volunteer. This was a roan-colored hunting bitch named Styx, who belonged to Perianthus, a Skirite ranger who was one of Leonidas's king's selections. The dog had followed its master down to Sparta from the hills, and now, having no home to return to, continued her attendance upon him. For an hour at a crack she would patrol the length of the column, all business, memorizing by scent the position of each member of the march, then returning to her Skirite master, who had now been nicknamed Hound, there to resume her tireless trot at his heel. There was no doubt that in the bitch's mind all these men belonged to her. She was herding us, Dionyces observed, and doing a hell of a job. With each passing mile, the countryside grew thinner. Everyone was gone. At last, in the nation of the Phocians, nearing the gates, the column entered country utterly denuded and abandoned. Leonidas dispatched runners into the mountain fastnesses to which the army of the locals had withdrawn, informing them in the name of the Hellenic Congress that the allies stood indeed upon the site and that it was their intention to defend the Phocians and Locrians' country, whether these themselves showed their faces or not. The king's message was not inscribed upon the customary military dispatch roll, but scribbled on that kind of linen wrapper used to invite family and friends to a dance. The final sentence read, "Come as you are." The allies themselves reached the village of Alpinoi that afternoon, the sixth after the march out from Lacedaemon, and Thermopylae itself half an hour later. Unlike the countryside, the battlefield, or what would become the battlefield, stood far from deserted. A number of denizens of Alpinoi and Anthela, the north-end village that fronts the stream called Phoenix, had erected makeshift commercial ventures. Several had barley and wheat bread baking. One fellow had set up a grog shop. A pair of enterprising trollops had even established a two-women brothel in one of the abandoned bathhouses. This became known at once as the Sanctuary of Aphrodite Fallen, or the Two-Holer, depending upon who was seeking directions and who proffering them. The Persians, the rangers reported, had not yet reached Trachis either by land or sea. The plain to the north lay yet unpopulated by the enemy camp. The fleet of the empire, it was reported, had put out from Therma in Macedonia either yesterday or the day before. Their 1,000 warships were even now traversing the Magnesia coast, the advance elements expected to reach the landing beaches at Ophiti, 8 miles north, within 24 hours. The land forces of the enemy had departed Therma 10 days earlier. Their columns were advancing, so fugitives from the north reported, via the coastal and inland routes, cutting through forests as they came. Their rangers were anticipated at the same time as the fleet. Now Leonidas emerged to the fore. Before the allied camps were even staked out, the king dispatched raiding parties into the country of Trachis, immediately north of the gates. These were to torch every stalk of grain and capture or drive off every piece of livestock, down to hedgehogs and barn cats, which might make a meal for the enemy. In the wake of these raiders, reconnaissance parties were sent out, surveyors and engineers from each Allied detachment, with orders to proceed as far north as the landing beaches likely to be appropriated by the Persians. These men were to map the area as best they could in the gathering darkness, concentrating upon the roads and trails available to the Persian in his advance to the Narrows. Although the Allied force possessed no cavalry, Leonidas made certain to include skilled horsemen in this party, though afoot they could best assess how enemy cavalry might operate. Could Xerxes get horsemen up the trail? How many? How fast? How could the Allies best counter this? Further, the reconnaissance parties were to apprehend and detain any locals whose topographical knowledge could be of assistance to the Allies. Leonidas wanted yard-by-yard intelligence of the immediate northern approaches and, most crucial, recalling Tempi, an ironclad assessment of the mountain defiles south and west, seeking any undiscovered track by which the Greek position could be outflanked and enveloped. At this point, a prodigy occurred, which nearly broke the Allies' will before they had even unshouldered their kits. An infantryman of the Thebans trod accidentally into a nest of baby snakes and received upon the bare ankle the full poison of half a dozen infant serpents, whose venom, all hunters know, is more to be feared than a full groan's because the young ones have not yet learned how to deal it out in doses, but instead inject it into the flesh in full measure. The infantryman died within the hour amid horrible sufferings, despite being bled white by the surgeons. Megistius the seer was summoned while the stricken Theban writhed yet in the throes. The remainder of the army, ordered by Leonidas to assess at once the extension and reinforcement of the ancient Phocian wall across the gates, nonetheless, amid their labors, loitered with cold dread as the snake-bitten man's life, emblematic all felt of their own, ebbed rapidly and agonizingly. It was Megistius's son, at last, who thought to inquire the man's name. This was, his mates reported, Perses. At once all omen-spawned gloom dispelled as Megistius stated the prodigy's meaning, which could not have been plainer. This man, ill-starred in his mother's election of name, represented the enemy who had, in invading Greece, stepped into a litter of serpents. Unfledged though these were, and disunited, the fanged babes yet stood capable of delivering their venom into the foe's vital stream and bringing him low. Night had fallen when this fortune-crossed fellow expired. Leonidas had him interred immediately with honor, then returned the men's hands at once to work. Orders were issued for every stonemason within the Allied ranks to present himself, regardless of unit. Chisels, picks, and levers were collected, and more sent for from Alpinoi village and the surrounding countryside. The party set forth down the track to Trachis. The masons were ordered to destroy as much of the trail as possible, and also to chisel into the stone, in plainest view, the following message. Greeks conscripted by Xerxes, if under compulsion you must fight us, your brothers, fight badly. Simultaneously, work was begun on rebuilding the ancient Phocian wall which blocked the Narrows. This fortification, when the Allies arrived, was little more than a pile of rubble. Leonidas demanded a proper battle wall. A wry scene ensued as various engineers and draftsmen of the Allied militias assembled in solemn council to survey the site and propose architectural alternatives. Torches had been positioned to light the Narrows. Diagrams were sketched in the dirt. One of the captains of the Corinthians produced an actual drawn-to-scale blueprint. Now the commanders began wrangling. The wall should be erected right at the Narrows, blocking the pass. No, suggested another, better it should be set back 50 meters, creating a triangle of death between the cliffs and the battle wall. A third captain urged a setback distance of twice that, giving the Allied infantry room to mass and maneuver. Meanwhile, the troops loitered about, as Hellenes will, offering their own sage counsel and wisdom. Leonidas simply picked up a boulder and marched to a spot. There he set the stone in place. He lifted a second and placed it beside the first. The men looked on dumbly as their commander-in-chief, whom all could see was well past 60, stooped to seize a third boulder. Someone barked, "How long do you imbeciles intend to stand by gaping? Will you wait all night while the king builds the wall himself?" With a cheer, the troops fell to. Nor did Leonidas cease from his exertions when he saw other hands joined to labor, but continued alongside the men as the pile of stones began to rise into a legitimate fortress. "Nothing fancy, brothers," the king guided the construction, "for a wall of stone will not preserve Hellas, but a wall of men." As he had done at every engagement at which it had been my privilege to observe him, the king stripped and worked alongside his warriors, shirking nothing but pausing to address individuals, calling by name those he knew, committing to memory the names and even nicknames of others heretofore unknown to him, often clapping these new mates upon the back in the manner of a comrade and friend. It was astonishing with what celerity these intimate words, spoken only to one man or two, were relayed warrior to warrior down the line, filling the hearts of all with courage. It was now the changing of the first watch. "Bring me the villain." With these words, Leonidas summoned an outlaw of the region who had fallen in with the column along the route and enlisted for pay to aid in reconnaissance. Two Scyrtae brought the man forward. To my astonishment, I knew him. This was the youth of my own country, who called himself Sphyrius, ball-player, the wild boy who had taken to the hills following my city's destruction, and had kicked about a man's stuffed skull as his sign of outlaw princeship. Now this criminal advanced into the margins of the king's fire, no longer a smooth-cheeked boy, but a scarred and bearded man, grown. I approached him. The fellow recognized me. He was delighted to resume our acquaintance and vastly amused at the fate which had brought us, two orphans of fire and sword, to this, the very epicenter of Hellas's peril. The outlaw stood in sizzling high spirits over the prospect of war. He would haunt its margins and prey upon the broken and the vanquished. War to him was big business. It was clear without words that he thought me a dunce for electing to serve and for not a penny's pay or profit. "Whatever happened to that tasty bit of steam you used to tramp with?" he asked me. "What was her name, your cousin?" "Steam" was the salacious slang of my country for a female of fair and tender years. "She's dead," I lied. "And you will be too for the price of another word." "Easy, countrymen, back your oars. I'm only fanning the breeze." The king's officers summoned the brigand away before he and I could speak further. Leonidas needed a buck whose soles knew how to grip the hard-scrabbled track of a goat trail, some stout heart to scramble up the sheer 3,000-foot face of Calydramus, which towered above the narrows. He wanted to know what was up top and how dangerous it was to get there. Once the enemy took possession of the Trachinian plain and the northern approaches, could the allies get a party, even a single man, across the shoulder of the mountain and into their rear? Ballplayer appeared decidedly unenthusiastic about his participation in this hazardous venture. "I'll go with him," this from the Scyrtae hound, a mountaineer himself. "Anything to get off building this miserable wall." Leonidas accepted this offer with alacrity. He instructed his paymaster to compensate the outlaw handsomely enough to get him to go, but poorly enough to make sure he came back. Around midnight, the Phocians and Locrians of Opus began arriving from the mountains. The king welcomed the fresh allies warmly, making no mention of their near desertion, but instead guiding them at once to that section of the camp which had been assigned to their use, and in which hot broth and freshly baked loaves awaited them. A terrific storm had sprung up north along the coast. Bolts resounded furiously in the distance. Though the sky above the gate stood yet clear and brilliant, the men were getting spooked. They were tired. The 6 days' hump had taken the starch out of them. Fears unspoken and demons unseen began to prey upon their hearts. Nor could the newly arrived Phocians and Locrians fail to discern the slender, not to say suicidally small, numbers of the force which proposed to hold off the myriads of the enemy. The native vendors, even the whores, had vanished like rats, evacuating to their holes, presaging a quake. There was a man among the loitering locals, a merchantman's mate, he said, who had sailed for years out of Sidon and Tyre. I chanced to be present around a fire of the Arcadians when this fellow began to fan the flames of terror. He had seen the Persian fleet firsthand and had the following tale to tell. "I was on a grain galley out of Mytilene last year. We got taken by Phoenicians, part of the great king's fleet. They confiscated our cargo. We had to trail them in under escort and unload it at one of his supply magazines. This was at Strymon on the Thracian coast. The sight I beheld there numbed the senses with awe." More men began to cluster about the circle, listening gravely. "The dump was big as a city. One thought coming in that a range of hills stood beyond it. But when you got close, the hills turned out to be salt meat, towering in hogsheads of brine stacked to the heavens. I saw weapons, brothers, stands of arms by the tens of thousands, grain and oil, baker's tents the size of stadiums. Every article of war material the mind could imagine. Sling bullets, lead sling bullets stacked a foot high, covering an acre. The trough of oats for the king's horses was a mile long, and in the middle of all rose one oilcloth-shrouded pyramid big as a mountain. What in heaven could be under that?" I asked the officer of marines guarding us. "Come on," he says, "I'll show you. Can you guess, my friends, what rose there, stacked to the sky beneath those covers?" "Paper," the ship's mate declared. None of the Arcadians grasped the significance. "Paper," the Trachinian repeated as if to drum the meaning into his hearers' thick skulls. "Paper for scribes to take inventory, inventory of men, horses, arms, grain, orders for troops and more orders, papers for reports and requisitions, muster rolls and dispatches, courts-martial and decorations for valor. Paper to keep track of every supply the great king is bringing and every item of loot he plans on taking back. Paper to write down countries burned and cities sacked, prisoners taken, slaves in chains." At this moment my master chanced to arrive at the gathering's margins. He discerned at once the terror graven upon the listeners' faces. Without a word he pressed forward into the firelight. At the sight of a Spartiate officer among his listeners, the ship's mate redoubled his fervor. He was enjoying the current of dread his tale had spawned. "But the most fearsome remains yet to be told, brothers," the Trachinian continued. "That same day, as our jailers marched us to supper, we passed the Persian archers in their practice. Not the Olympian gods themselves could have assembled such myriads. I swear to you, mates, so numerous were the multitudes of bowmen that when they fired their volleys, the mass of arrows blocked out the sun." The rumor-monger's eyes burned with pleasure. He turned to my master as if to savor the flame of dread his tale had ignited even in a Spartan. To his disappointment, Dionyces regarded him with a cool, almost bored detachment. "Good," he said. "Then we'll have our battle in the shade." In the middle of the second watch came the first panic. I was still awake, securing my master's covered shield against the rain which threatened, when I heard the telltale rustle of bodies shifting, the alteration in the rhythm of men's voices. A terror-swept camp sounds completely different from a confident one. Dionyces rose out of a sound sleep, like a sheepdog sensing murmurs of disquiet among his fold. "Mother of bitches," he grunted, "it's starting already." The first raiding parties had returned to camp. They had seen torches, cavalry brands of the Persians' mounted rangers, and had made their own prudent withdrawal before getting cut off. You could see the foe plainly now, they reported, from the shoulder of the mountain, 2 miles or less down the trail. Some of the forward sentries had made sorties on their own as well, and these had now returned to camp to confirm the report. Beyond the shoulder of Calydromus, upon the sprawling plain of Trachis, the advance units of the Persians were arriving. Chapter 22. Within minutes of the sighting of the enemy forerunners, Leonidas had the entire Spartan contingent on its feet and armed, with orders to the allies to marshal in succession and be ready to move forward. The remainder of that night and all the next day were consumed with ravaging in earnest the plain of Trachis and the hillsides above, penetrating along the coast as far north as the Spercheius and inland to the citadel and the Trachinian cliffs. Watchfires were set across the entire plain, not little rabbit roasters as customary, but roaring bonfires to create the impression of vast numbers of men. The allied units shouted insults and imprecations to one another across the darkness, trying to sound as cheerful and confident as possible. By morning, the plain was blanketed end to end in fire smoke and sea fog, exactly as Leonidas wanted. I was among the final four parties, stoking bonfires as the murky dawn came up over the gulf. We could see the Persians, mounted reconnaissance units and marine archers of the foe's fast scout corvettes upon the far bank of the Spercheius. We shouted insults, and they shouted back. The day passed, and another. Now the main force units of the foe began streaming in. The plain commenced to fill with the enemy. All Greek parties withdrew before the Median tide. The scouts could see the king's officers claiming the prime sites for his majesty's pavilions and staking out the luscious pasturage for his horses. They knew the Greeks were here, and the Greeks knew they were. That night Leonidas summoned my master and the other Enomotarchi, the platoon leaders, to the low knoll behind the Phocian wall, upon which he had established his command post. Here the king began to address the Spartan officers. Meanwhile, the commanders from the other allied cities, also summoned to council, began arriving. The timing of this was as the king intended. He wanted the allied officers to overhear the words he spoke seemingly for Spartan ears alone. "Brothers and comrades," Leonidas addressed the Lacedaemonians clustered about him, "it appears that the Persian, despite our impressive showmanship, remains unconvinced of the prudence of packing his kit and embarking for home. It looks like we're going to have to fight him after all. Hear, then, what I expect from each of you. You are the elect of Hellas, officers and commanders of the nation of Lacedaemon, chosen by the Isthmian Congress to strike the first blow in defense of our homeland. Remember that our allies will take their cue from you. If you show fear, they will be afraid. If you project courage, they will match it in kind. Our deportment here must not differ from any other campaign. On the one hand, no extraordinary precautions. On the other, no unwanted recklessness. Above all, the little things. Maintain your men's training schedule without alteration. Omit no sacrifice to the gods. Continue your gymnastics and drills at arms. Take time to dress your hair, as always. If anything, take more time." By now the allied officers had arrived at the council fire and were assuming their stations amid the already assembled Spartans. Leonidas continued as if to his own countrymen, but with an ear to the new arrivals as well. "Remember that these, our allies, have not trained their whole lives for war as we have. They are farmers and merchants, citizen soldiers of their city's militias. Nonetheless, they are not unmindful of valor, or they would not be here. For the Phocians and Locrians of Opus, this is their country. They fight to defend home and family. As for the men of the other cities, Thebans and Corinthians and Tegeates, Orchomenians and Arcadians, Phlians, Thespians, Mantineans, and the men of Mycenae, these display to my mind even nobler Andrea, for they come uncompelled not to defend their own hearths, but all Greece." He motioned the new arrivals forward. "Welcome, brothers. Since I find myself among allies, I am making a long-winded speech." The officers settled in with an anxious chuckle. "I am telling the Spartans," Leonidas resumed, "what I now tell you. You are the commanders. Your men will look to you and act as you do. Let no officer keep to himself or his brother officers, but circulate day long among his men. Let them see you and see you unafraid. Where there is work to do, turn your hand to it first. The men will follow. Some of you, I see, have erected tents. Strike them at once. We will all sleep as I do, in the open. Keep your men busy. If there is no work, make it up. For when soldiers have time to talk, their talk turns to fear. Action, on the other hand, produces the appetite for more action. Exercise campaign discipline at all times. Let no man heed nature's call without spear and shield at his side. Remember that the Persian's most formidable weapons, his cavalry and his multitudes of archers and slingers, are rendered impotent here by the terrain. That is why we chose this site. The enemy can get no more than a dozen men at a time through the narrows and mass no more than 1,000 before the wall. We are 4,000. We outnumber him 4-1. This produced the first genuine laughter. Leonidas sought to instill courage not by his words alone, but by the calm and professional manner with which he spoke them. War is work, not mystery. The king confined his instructions to the practical, prescribing actions which could be taken physically rather than seeking to produce a state of mind which he knew would evaporate as soon as the commanders dispersed beyond the fortifying light of the king's fire. Look to your grooming, gentlemen. Keep your hair, hands, and feet clean. Eat, if you have to choke it down. Sleep, or pretend to. Don't let your men see you toss. If bad news comes, relay it first to those in grade above you, never directly to your men. Instruct your squires to buff each man's aspice to its most brilliant sheen. I want to see shields flashing like mirrors, for this sight strikes terror into the enemy. Leave time for your men to sharpen their spears, for he who whets his steel whets his courage. As for your men's understandable anxiety concerning the immediate hours, tell them this. I anticipate action neither tonight nor tomorrow, not even the day after. The Persian needs time to marshal his men, and the more myriads he is burdened with, the longer this will take. He must wait upon the arrival of his fleet. Beaching grounds are scarce and slender upon this inhospitable coast. It will take the Persian days to lay out roadsteads and secure at anchor his thousands of warships and transports. Our own fleet, as you know, holds the strait at Artemisium. Breaking through will require of the enemy a full-scale sea battle. Preparing for this will consume even more of his time. As for assaulting us here in the pass, the foe must reconnoiter our position, then deliberate how best to attack it. No doubt he will send emissaries first, seeking to achieve by diplomacy what he hesitates to hazard at the cost of blood. This you need not concern yourselves with, for all treating with the enemy will be done by me. Here Leonidas bent to the earth and lifted a stone thrice the size of a man's fist. Believe me, comrades, when Xerxes addresses me, he might as well be talking to this. He spat upon the rock and slung it away into the dark. Another thing. You have all heard the oracle declaring that Sparta will either lose a king in battle or the city herself be extinguished. I have taken the omens, and the god has answered that I am that king, and that this site will be my grave. Be assured, however, that this foreknowledge will nowise render me reckless with other men's lives. I swear to you now, by all the gods and by the souls of my children, that I will do everything in my power to spare you and your men, as many as I possibly can, and still defend the pass effectively. Finally this, brothers and allies. Wherever the fighting is bloodiest, you may expect to discover the Lacedaemonians in the forefront. But convey this above all to your men. Let them not yield preeminence in valor to the Spartans, rather strive to outdo them. Remember, in warfare, practice of arms counts for little. Courage tells all. And we Spartans have no monopoly on that. Lead your men with this in mind, and all will be well. Chapter 23. It was the standing order of my master on campaign that he be woken 2 hours before dawn, an hour prior to the men of his platoon. He insisted that these never behold him prone upon the earth, but awake always to the sight of their inamatarch, on his feet and armed. This night Dionyces slept even less. I felt him stir and roused myself. "Lie still," he commanded. His hand pressed me back down. "It's not even past second watch." He had dozed without removing his corselet and now creaked to his feet, all his scarred joints groaning. I could hear him crack the bones of his neck and hawk dry phlegm from the lungs he had seared at Inoue, inhaling fire, which wound, like the others, had never truly healed. "Let me help you, sir."
"Sleep. Don't make me tell you twice."
He snatched one of his spears from the stacked arms and shouldered his aspis by its sling cord. He took his helmet, seating it by its nasal into the war pack he now slung across his shoulders. He gimped off on his bad ankle. He was making for Leonidas's cluster among the knights, where the king would be awake and perhaps wanting company. Across the cramped confines, the camp slumbered. A waxing moon stood above the strait, the air unseasonably chill for summer, dank as it is by the sea, and made more raw by the recent storms. You could hear the breakers clearly, combing in at the base of the cliffs. I glanced across at Alexandros, pillowed upon his shield beside the snoring form of suicide. Watchfires had banked down. Across the camp, the sleeping warriors' forms had stilled into lumpy piles of cloaks and sleeping capes that looked more like sacks of discarded laundry than men. Toward the middle gate I could see the bathhouses of the spa. These were cheerful structures of unmilled lumber, their stone thresholds worn smooth by the tread of bathers and summer visitors dating from centuries. The oiled paths meandered prettily under the oaks, lit by the olive-wood lamps of the spa. A burnished wood plaque hung beneath each lamp, a snatch of verse carved upon it. I recall one. "As at birth the soul steps into the liquid body, so step you now, friend, into these baths, releasing flesh into soul, reunited, divine." I remembered something my master had once said about battlefields. This was at Tritia, when the army met the Achaeans in a field of seedling barley. The climactic slaughter had taken place opposite a temple to which in time of peace the deranged and god-possessed were conveyed by their families to pray and offer sacrifice to Demeter Merciful and Persephone. No surveyor marks out a tract and declares, "Here we shall have a battle." The ground is often consecrated to a peaceful purpose, frequently one of succor and compassion. The irony can get pretty thick sometimes. And yet within Hellas's mountainous and topographically hostile confines, there existed those sites hospitable to war. Inophyta, Tanagra, Coronia, Marathon, Chaeronea, Leuctra, those plains and defiles upon and within which armies had clashed for generations. This pass of the Hot Gates was such a sight. Here in these precipitous straits, contending forces had slugged it out as far back as Jason and Heracles. Hill tribes had fought here, savage clans and seaborne raiders, migrating hordes, barbarians and invaders of the north and west. The tides of war and peace had alternated in this site for centuries, bathers and warriors, one come for the waters, the other for blood. The battle wall had now been completed. One end abutted the sheer face of the cliff, with a stout tower flush to the stone, the other tailing off at an angle across the slope to the cliffs and the sea. It was a good-looking wall, 2 spear lengths thick at the base and twice the height of a man. The face toward the enemy had not been erected sheer in the manner of a city battlement, but left deliberately sloped right up to the actual sally ports at the crest, where the final 4 feet rose vertical as a fortress. This was so the warriors of the Allies could scamper rearward to safety if they had to, and not find themselves pinned and crushed against their own wall. The rear face sloped up in stacked steps for the defenders to mount to the battlements, atop which had been anchored a stout timber palisade, sheathed in hides which the standing watches could cast loose, so that the tow arrows of the enemy would not set the palisade alight. The masonry was ragged stuff, but sturdy. Towers stood at intervals, reinforcing redoubts right, left, and center, and secondary walls behind these. These strong points had been built solid to the height of the primary wall, then stacked with heavy stones to a man's height beyond. These loose boulders could be tumbled, should necessity dictate, into the breaches of the lower sally ports. I could see the sentries now atop the wall, and the three ready platoons, two Arcadian and one Spartan, in full panoplia at each redoubt. Leonidas was in fact awake. His long steel-colored hair could be distinguished clearly beside the commander's fire. Dianeces attended him there among a knot of officers. I could make out Dithyrambus, the Thespian captain, Leontiades, the Theban commander, Polyneikes, the brothers Alpheus and Maron, and several other Spartan knights. The sky had begun to lighten. I became aware of forms stirring beside me. Alexandros and Ariston had come awake as well, and now roused themselves and took station beside me. These young warriors, like myself, found their gaze drawn irresistibly to the officers and champions surrounding the king. The veterans, all knew, would acquit themselves with honor. "How will we do?" Alexandros put into words the anxiety that loitered unspoken in his youthful mates' hearts. "Will we find the answer to Dianeces' question? Will we discover within ourselves the opposite of fear?" 3 days before the march out from Sparta, my master had assembled the warriors and squires of his platoon and outfitted a hunt at his own expense. This was in the form of a farewell, not to each other, but to the hills of their native country. None spoke a word of the gates or of the trials to come. It was a grand outing, blessed by the gods with several excellent kills, including a fine boar brought down in its charge by suicide in Ariston with the javelin and the foot-braced pike. At dusk, the hunters, beyond a dozen with twice that number of squires and helots serving as beaters, settled in high spirits about several fires among the hills above Therai. Phobos took a seat as well. As the other huntsmen made merry around their separate blazes, diverting themselves with lies of the chase and good-fellow jesting, Dianeces cleared space beside his own station for Alexandros and Ariston and bade them sit. I discerned then my master's subtle intent. He was going to speak of fear. For these unblooded youths, whom he knew despite their silence, or perhaps because of it, had begun in their hearts to dwell upon the trials to come. "All my life," Dianeces began, "one question has haunted me. What is the opposite of fear?" Down the slope the boar flesh was coming ready. Portions were being shared out to eager hands. Suicide came up with bowls for Dianeces, Alexandros, and Ariston, and one apiece for himself, Ariston's squire, Demades, and me. He settled on the earth across from Dianeces, flanked by two of the hounds who had noses for the scraps and knew suicide as a notorious soft touch. "To call it aphobia, fearlessness, is without meaning. This is just a name, thesis expressed as antithesis. To call the opposite of fear fearlessness is to say nothing. I want to know its true obverse, as day of night and heaven of earth." "Expressed as a positive," Ariston ventured. "Exactly." Dianeces met the young man's eyes in approval. He paused to study both youths' expressions. Would they listen? Did they care? Were they, like him, true students of this subject? "How does one conquer fear of death, that most primordial of terrors, which resides in our very blood, as in all life, beasts as well as men?" He indicated the hounds flanking suicide. "Dogs in a pack find courage to take on a lion. Each hound knows his place. He fears the dog ranked above and feeds off the fear of the dog below. Fear conquers fear. This is how we Spartans do it, counterpoising to fear of death a greater fear, that of dishonor, of exclusion from the pack." Suicide took this moment to toss several scraps to the dogs. Furiously their jaws snapped these remnants from the turf, the stronger of the two seizing the lion's share. Dianeces smiled darkly. "But is that courage? Is not acting out of fear of dishonor still, in essence, acting out of fear? Alexandros asked what he was seeking. Something nobler, a higher form of the mystery, pure, infallible. He declared that in all other questions one may look for wisdom to the